It's the Bill Simmons Podcast presented by FanDuel. The NBA season hitting full stride. Don't miss your chance to win some money with America's number one sportsbook. I mean, post-trade deadline, we had one of the craziest trade deadlines we've ever had in the history of the league. We have Fox on San Antonio, Luka on the Lakers, Kuzma on the Bucks. Kidding. The Cavs got better, so you have a chance to get all these new look teams and maybe just ride Luka and his point over in the Lakers to win as a parlay over and over again as he gets vengeance on the Mavericks. Bet on fun markets like live quarter player props and parlays. Enjoy our new NBA player prop pages. The app is safe and secure and easy to use. And when you win, you'll get paid instantly. So download the app today. Bet with FanDuel, an official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com. To learn more about the resources and helplines available and listen to the end of the episode for additional details. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem, call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. Hey, if you missed it, we launched a brand new podcast on the Ringer Podcast Network and Spotify. It is called Good Hang with Amy Poehler. First episode is dropping fairly soon. Within the next couple of days, you can follow it on Spotify. Video podcast too. The Bill Simmons Podcast is brought to you by the Ringer Podcast Network. We put up a new Rewatchables on Monday. We did the Blues Brothers in honor of SNL 50. You can watch it on the Ringer Movies YouTube channel as well. You can watch a lot of the videos and clips from this podcast on the Bill Simmons YouTube channel. This is a big episode for us because this is our first video episode of the Bill Simmons Podcast on Spotify. Every episode from now on will be a video episode on Spotify. You can put it on your phone. You can just listen to it. You can pull your phone out. You can watch it. You can go on your smart TV, your PS5, your Roku, your Apple TV, wherever you want to get it. Watch it on the Spotify app. Whatever you want to do. Knock yourself out. We are a video podcast from now on. I've had this podcast since 2007. So year 18. It's basically now, I guess, a TV show. A very low budget TV show, as you can see with my hastily put together posters behind me. This podcast, really fun episode. Brian Curtis talking Super Bowl, Luka trade, day 10, still going. And then Matt Bellany talking SNL 50, the Oscars, Lively versus Baldoni, most famous celebrity right now. A lot of good stuff. It's all next. First, we couldn't lose them on the video podcast. Our friends from Pearl Jam. All right, editor-at-large of The Ringer, Brian Curtis, is here. We're recording on a Tuesday morning, action-packed. A lot of Brian's interests are in play. And we're going to talk about the Mavericks and one of the craziest NBA situations in a long time. But we'll start quickly with the Super Bowl. Hey, newsflash, the Cowboys didn't win another Super Bowl. It's been over 3 decades since the last time. We did have the Eagles win. We had the end of Mahomes. We had a lot of takes. Sal and I were doing stuff on Sunday night about Mahomes getting kicked off Code Island. What was the media reaction yesterday? What jumped out to you? What did you enjoy?
Well, I think we had a little bit of a Chiefs take crisis with the Super Bowl before the game.
We did.
Did you see all the people trying to make the Chiefs into villains? Like the Pats, like the 90s Yankees?
Yeah.
And they're not villains. They're just not. They're not hated on that scale yet, I don't believe. And people try to, you know, we're tired of them. We're pissed off at Taylor Swift. The refs are in their pocket. And yeah, they were just trying to get us there that we all hated the Chiefs and were rooting against them. But I don't actually believe that was the case. I think we might be a little tired of them being good. We might have been kind of annoyed at the way they won games this year. But I don't think they're hated at all. And then my favorite, Bill, was
Hold on that, though. Who was the best? Who was central casting for best villain? Was it just Duke basketball in the 90s? Who was the easiest to put right in there?
Yeah.
Because even the Yankees, like, I hated the Yankees, but I was like, all right, Jeter, I kind of like. He seems like a nice guy. You know, it was more the fan base than the team itself. Duke basketball seemed like that was the easiest one.
Duke was at the top of the scale. The Yankees had the thing where they were outspending everybody and kind of everybody thought they were ruining baseball. So
that's
a
good piece
mixed in there.
Yeah. When you're ruining stuff, that's always a good one. I'm trying to think who else. Like the Pats,
because of the Spygate, I felt like that. In the first three Super Bowls, people were like, all right, enough with these guys. But it was a little like the Chiefs thing. But then when Spygate happened, then they became criminals, basically. And that moved it to another level.
And then they had a hateable coach, which is another thing the Chiefs lacked. Like, people don't hate Andy Reid.
No.
They just don't. Bill Belichick was hateable. Probably still is hateable in his own way, even as he's tried to rehabilitate his image all year. But I think with the Chiefs, people are just like, yeah, okay.
They had the Taylor Swift thing, a lot of Kelce, a lot of both Kelces.
A lot of commercials.
They were moving a little bit toward the Trump side of stuff, which I think got a couple people ruffled up. But for the most part, I don't know. My biggest issue with them was they made it so unfun to talk about the Super Bowl, which we talked about on Sunday night, where it's just like, if you pick them, you kind of feel, you just say, Andy Reid, Mahomes. You had no other reason. If you didn't pick them, you felt like an idiot. So it was, I think, the worst Super Bowl to talk about since I've been doing this.
I think so, but I, like you, talk myself into the Chiefs are going to win it. It's going to be a close game.
It was the first time I ever got slaughtered on a Super Bowl and didn't feel bad really at all. I was like, what are you going to do? You can't go against them again. What was the other thing you were going to say about the villain thing?
Well, I was just saying, like, once the villain thing kind of didn't work out, that you heard this amazing take on ESPN and elsewhere. People said, don't be tired of the Chiefs. Appreciate greatness when it's in front of you.
Yeah.
And I was like, what a counterintuitive take. You should appreciate a great football team. Whoa.
Good tag.
Go settle down, guys.
What was it like as a TV viewer for the Brady Mahomes experience? Brady announcing the game where Mahomes' GOAT resume got knocked backwards by about 4 years.
So it was a little bit weird, right? First of all, Brady actually got to go to the meetings this week. And apparently, I was told there was a scene in one of the meetings where he and Mahomes were just sitting off by themselves talking.
Oh.
And people in the meeting, Fox producer was like, look at that. I mean, that's kind of awesome. These two dudes just talking football. It was just one of those moments where you're like, whoa, GOAT plus GOAT. Well, almost GOAT talking to each other about football. But then it gets to the game and Mahomes just sucks at the beginning of the game. He was terrible. You nailed this on Sunday night. So Brady, I thought, never got to talk about Mahomes' greatness in an interesting way. And at the same time, he kind of made a mistake because he didn't really kill Mahomes. He was talking about how good the Eagles defense was.
Well, and that's where probably Romo, but I think Aikman would have been the best because Aikman just doesn't give a shit anymore. Aikman, I think, probably would have been the hardest on him, right?
I think so. But you know what? One thing you could tell with Brady this year, and this is kind of one of the most fascinating subplots of Brady announcer experiment, was you could tell what quarterbacks he liked and what quarterbacks he didn't and what quarterbacks he thought didn't measure up. Jalen Hurts, by the way, was in the second category.
Yeah.
Every Jalen Hurts game, he would say, Jalen Hurts is better when he gets the ball out of his hands quickly.
Yep. And he would get mad when he held it too long and got sacked or had to run out, throw it out of bounds. Brady would be exasperated.
Which is a nice way of saying he's pretty limited, right?
Like, yeah.
He can do certain things, but he can't do other things. Well, what happens during the Super Bowl? Jalen Hurts kind of balls out. He plays better than Patrick Mahomes. So you could feel Brady really processing that.
Yeah.
In real time. And he sort of got, he has a great instinct on when to leave the pocket because he was beating all those rushes and blitzes, right? By running. And he kind of got himself there. And he gave Hurts his due. I don't want to say he didn't do that, but that was just funny to hear in real time.
Yeah. And it seems like after 48 hours, the second level analysis stuff is, the Eagles actually, like, go the 2000 Ravens and some of the other great Super Bowl teams. Where do they go? Where do they rank ahead of them? And then it feels like people are kind of test driving some Mahomes stuff. Mm. And even people in my life where it's like, are we sure? Are we like, just because they pulled out all these close games, like, why don't they have explosive plays anymore? The guy's about to hit 30. Could you say he peaked a couple years ago just as an explosive, awesome quarterback? Like, there's always all these excuses around him. Are we sure? Which I remember hit Brady in the late 2000s too. There was some are we sure stuff. So I don't think anyone feels really committed to anything. The biggest thing that shocked me, and I feel like I say this every year and it feels like it just speeds up by probably an hour every year. But going back, we both loved like Sports Illustrated in the 80s. The Super Bowl would happen. People would talk about it. It would be on SportsCenter for 4 straight days. And then the Sports Illustrated would come out on Thursday with like the final statement of the game. And then that started to shrink as the internet came, and it kept shrinking. It kept shrinking. But even like when I was at ESPN, Sal and I used to do like Monday afternoon recaps of the Super Bowl. Then that became Monday mornings. Then eventually we're just going immediately as fast as we could after the game. And now it feels like the shelf life to discuss the Super Bowl is 18 hours. Is it longer than that? Like, does anyone, even us leading the podcast with this today, I want to do it because I love talking about all the ancillary stuff with you. But it's like, is it too late? Is it too late to talk about the Super Bowl on a Tuesday morning?
I totally agree. I watched the late Sports Center on Sunday night after I think right before I listened to you. And at that moment, I was kind of like, am I done with the Super Bowl?
Is this it? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, we had a pod to do the next day, but I was like, have I consumed everything I'm going to consume about the Eagles beating the Chiefs? And right. The answer is almost yes. I think I had, because I mean, here's the other part of that. You just consume so much now. I mean, you had to wait till Thursday with that SI thing to get all the details. And, you know, what was Vic Fangio like in the locker room afterwards? I mean, Sheil wrote that, you know, for us right away.
Right.
So in a way, it was just all kind of there for us. And we don't really need to wait.
And there's no like, nobody's parachuting in on like Monday at 3 p.m. with this amazing angle that nobody's thought of. You kind of know what all the angles are going to be by, you know, 10 p.m. on Sunday night, PT.
I think the one exception was, remember that year Peter King went and hung out with Tom Brady and Giselle, and was it Montana up in the cabin like a week later?
Right.
It feels so old school now, but like, yeah, we're with Brady and he's reflecting on the game and giving me like an hour. That I don't think he would do anymore.
I actually felt like the halftime show and the Kendrick Drake stuff and how polarizing that show ended up being almost became more of a theme on Monday, at least in on my text threads and the stuff I was reading. It was more interesting to read how people were receiving stuff, the hidden meanings behind some of the stuff Kendrick did on the halftime and Serena being in it. That one had these levels that kept getting revealed. That used to be how the Super Bowl operated.
Totally, because what play are we talking about in the Super Bowl? You know, nothing from the second half.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that Mahomes pick six, which effectively ended the game in retrospect. By the way, you mentioned the Mahomes takes. I want to go there with you.
Yeah.
Because it feels like Mahomes will work himself into a nobody believes in me news cycle because just enough doubt, even if it's bullshit, just enough doubt. And also, Bill, Jalen Hurts, think about this. What were people talking about Sunday night, Monday morning? The Eagles defense. This was a win for the Eagles defense. So Jalen Hurts both win the Super Bowl MVP and pull off the unprecedented double play of being a nobody believed in me guy?
Has that ever happened before? Probably Brady somewhere in the first three Super Bowls where it was all Belichick and all the defense and Brady was kind of the supporting character in a lot of ways.
Sure.
I think it would be the only other time I can remember that happening.
He was seen as a facilitator. He was so good.
He was great. I mean, they basically put the game in his hands and dared him to beat them. And he did. With the Mahomes stuff, there's a couple fun wrinkles that could come out. He could go the NBA player route. Like if this was LeBron in the Mahomes spot, we'd already be getting the leaks about he needs more help. They didn't find him anyone this year. When Rashee Rice went out, they could have done this, that, and the other thing. They knew Kelsey was getting old. They've got to do more. He took less money. They'd basically make him a victim.
Wait, and I thought you were going to say he was secretly injured. When you said LeBron, I thought I had a secret injury.
Oh, that would be another one too. Yeah, he had like a quad injury. He couldn't push off his right foot. Yeah, they'd be doing all that stuff. But it kind of doesn't seem like Mahomes. Not only does he not do that stuff, but he always seems at peace, win or lose, after the game, right? We never see that stuff about, oh, this year Patrick Mahomes is different. He's pretty even keeled, which I think you have to be as a quarterback. The interesting thing to me, which we talked about Sunday night, was I really do think Kelsey was going to retire if they won. And the Kelsey, will he or will he not retire, I think will be fun. But just in general, like, it's really hard to keep these windows open, you know, with NFL teams. We went through it with the Patriots a few different times. It all depends on the drafts. People wrote some good pieces about, you know, they missed on their left tackle pick this year. You know, Rashee Rice, which would have been this awesome wide receiver pick for him. They missed. And so you can just tilt it a little bit, or all of a sudden you're catchable. And I think that was the thing that changed the most coming out of this season, was like the Chiefs not only feel super catchable now, we don't have to do the thing where we just hand them the game when we're talking about it. Now it's like football has opened up for analysis. So I'm excited for that. From a Super Bowl standpoint, the Brady Fox thing,
mm-hmm.
at the end, $375 million, whatever it is. They certainly got a lot of ink and publicity and podcast content. He was able to go on some of the Fox shows. He had a couple decent moments, like in traditional podcast interview stuff. I don't think from a game thing, I wouldn't even put him in the top 8 game guys I heard. He's got this weird Vegas minority stake and he's allegedly hiring the coach and he's involved in their draft. Like, is there a chance this is it? This is a one and done?
I don't think so. I don't think he sees it like that. I mean, that's from me poking around. I think he's into this. I mean, first of all, the NFL doesn't care about the Vegas thing, you know, other than the meetings. And yeah. And by the way, let's see where we are in year two with the meetings, because I'm not convinced that wouldn't change in year two. I think there's potential for that to be switched up by Goodell and everything after they've gone through that 1 year of this with him limited.
But yeah.
If you're him, you're getting $37.5 million to work for 6 months, work hard for 6 months, but work for 6 months. The NFL has said, we don't care if you're a minority owner of the Raiders. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I got to ask him on Super Bowl week what his role with the Raiders was, and he didn't tell me, and he didn't provide any detail about that. So I was like, okay. So he's not going to tell us, at least for now, about what he's doing with the Raiders. Doesn't have to come clean about it. I mean, seems like a pretty good deal to me.
I have been told pretty explicitly, it's too much money. There's no way he walks away.
Yeah.
It's too much money. And one thing I think people forget with the super duper famous celebrities, it's expensive to be a super duper famous celebrity. Because everywhere you go, you're paying for like some private jet. You know, in his case, he got divorced. Like, it's as much money as he's made, he still needs way more money to sustain the lifestyle he does. And this is a $37.5 million check every year. He's not giving it up if he doesn't have to. It's not that hard of a job. It's 22 weeks. You study one game. You fly to the site, like it's, you know, you have to keep in touch with the league a little bit, but not really. The stunning thing to me is Belichick. I, you know, this is not a midlife crisis because he's in his mid 70s, but even he was at Super Bowl, you know, he was at a couple parties. He was walking around with his girlfriend. We saw him at the Fanatics party on Saturday. It's just surreal. This guy who was wearing this, you know, saggy hoodie on the sidelines who just could care less what anyone thought. Now he's in the Dunkin' Donuts commercial with the girlfriend, and this girlfriend's 5 years older than my daughter. There was a lot of like, what the fuck is going on with this guy stuff in New Orleans over the weekend.
And he was wearing all the rings.
Which he never, the kind of thing he just never used to do.
Just as if to remind the NFL, I won all these rings and you didn't hire me again.
Right. I'm really starting to wonder, this is a working theory, I'm not done with it yet, but like 75 and up are just all bets off. It's just like literally are all bets off. We're talking about owners. Mm-hmm. Because in sports as fans, we have to deal with so many old people, and we all have old people in our family. You could see what happens as they hit their 70s, then their 80s. And the judgment just gets a little nuts. And I just wonder with Belichick, like, I can't believe some of this. I really find it hard to believe he's coaching North Carolina too. I get it. I understand why he did it. He didn't want to deal with owners anymore. He just wants to be a coach, all that stuff. But yet at the same time, seems like the celebrity aspect of this has become really appealing to him, which I never in a million years would have guessed.
It's interesting to watch that because Nick Saban's kind of done the same thing in the college level. And
right.
There's another guy who you're like, why would he care about this? But you know what? You go on those podcasts, you go on the TV shows, go on the Manning cast, everybody butters you up. You know, how many times did Bill Belichick get buttered up by media people when he was at the Pats last few
years? Never dealt with them. And then he had this really strange relationship with his owner and just kind of kept his little, it's just basically in a cave, just, you know, going through film.
Yeah, it's like the ESPN car wash, except it's, you know, not interviewing you. It's just telling you how great you are. All the time.
Really strange. It was the whole thing. I thought that was the weirdest subplot of the weekend. Then the other funny thing that I immediately thought of you. We always call it the Friday news dump. What the Sixers did with the Joel Embiid information that they held and held and held and pushed out.
Oh my God.
Right after the Eagles won the Super Bowl. What do we call it? This is a new level of news dump. The Super Bowl title. We didn't want to bum out our city. This was our only chance to put this out. News dump. What is this?
We clogged the toilet so much. The toilet wasn't fixable. We just had to throw it away. We had to put it on the curb. Yeah.
Why is there yellow tape and a door locked in the guest bathroom? Don't go in there.
It was so great.
Unprecedented. The best news dump, I think, ever. I never, ever remember a team pulling that off better. This crazy Embiid article where it's like, yeah, I'm probably never going to be healthy again. I may need surgery. I shouldn't have played the Olympics. It turns out all that. Like, it's like, oh my God, if they put that out on a Tuesday, it would have been like a 36-hour story. And instead, it just kind of came and went in 10 seconds.
Totally. Even during Super Bowl week, that would have been huge for a day.
Right.
It would have distracted us all.
What's your favorite news dump ever? I think that might have been mine. It's a really good one.
You're going to have to give me a minute on that one, but that's a good one.
Answer that on Press Box on Thursday. Do your top five news dumps on the Press Box pod.
I remember last year when he had all the amazing political stories and, you know, American stories. There was this thing on Twitter. It's like, if you have anything, now's the time. Send the press release. Just print it out. No one will notice.
I remember when I was working on my HBO show and we were doing like the test shows, and it was like 3 weeks before the show launched, and the guy who hired me to do the show, Michael Lombardo, and he was a huge advocate. And like 3 weeks before, it was like Friday afternoon, like 3:15 in the afternoon, and all of a sudden the stuff was out that he was out at HBO. And it was like, it was the only time I'd ever like really experienced the Friday news dump. It was so like perfectly calculated to just kind of sneak into the weekend with it. I was like, oh, this is how you do it. This is it. Because as any other day or moment, this would have been the biggest Hollywood story. And they were like, this is happening right here. It still happens. We're going to take a break and then we'll come back and we got to talk about this incredible Maverick situation.
Lust auf besonders feine Weihnachten? Erlebe einzigartigen Genuss mit Rewe Feine Welt. Diese Woche zum Beispiel Rewe Feine Welt Schweizer Käse Trüffeltraum mildwürzig, je 150 Gramm Packung nur 3,49 €. Oder Rewe Feine Welt italienischer Prosciutto Crudo, roher Schinken mit Meersalz behandelt, mindestens 18 Monate gereift, je 100 Gramm Packung nur 4,29 €. Festlich sparen mit Genuss. Rewe, dein Markt.
All right, so Curtis, you're from Texas. You're a lifelong Cowboys fan. You're a lifelong Mavericks fan, maybe not as much, but a student of the Mavericks. They've been in your life. It's been a rocky road. There's been a lot of ups and downs. Everything peaked in 2011 with Dirk Nowitzki and probably winning the title, beating Wade and LeBron and Bosh. And it got weird over the course of the decade. They miraculously end up with Luka Doncic. Cuban sells the team last year. They just seem like if you're picking six franchises you want to be for the next 10 years, they would have been one of the six because they had Luka. Out of nowhere, they trade him in the most shocking, craziest trade in the history of the NBA. And just when you think, all right, maybe this will settle down, it just hasn't. It just keeps going up a level and up a level and up a level. What just your big picture watching this from afar, holy shit, what is your take?
I feel like quoting that notorious Darren Revelle tweet, this is terrible for Dallas, but this is tremendous content. Because you recognize the pain. And I have never seen Dallas people this emotionally gutted.
Right, so even like Cowboys Super Bowl losses, nothing?
Well, it's okay. So maybe not gutted, but just angry. Like there have been a lot of angry Jerry moments over the last 30 years. I was in middle school when they fired Tom Landry. I was in high school when Jimmy Johnson got axed by Jerry. I remember those were just crazy citywide moments of like, what the hell just happened? But I've never seen the anger like I've seen over the last week and change. Just pissed off. I mean, like visiting even with Dallas sports radio guys. And by the way, Monday was one of the all-time sports radio days in Dallas history and probably American history when they were coming back and doing their shows.
Oh, and morning and through the afternoon, first time.
You were getting your first time to talk about it. Yeah. And I was like, you know, even going up to them, wow, what a day, huh? And they just look like gutted. I mean, you know, because everything changes. You know, this guy you loved, this person you were close to, the fact that it was done by Nico Harrison and Patrick Dumont, we'll probably get into here in a second.
Yeah.
And the way it was done and for what they got. I mean, every piece of it is just absolutely infuriating and gutting.
Well, and then this next level would happen at the home game yesterday where people are getting booed and they're removing fans, which removing fans for not doing anything that bad. They're just like being fans. Like I've never seen people get pulled out of the arena for the stuff that they got pulled out of last night. Have you?
Yeah. Do you see the one guy, right? So they're doing Mavs karaoke.
Yeah.
And they come in real close, like a close up on him. And he says, "Fire Nico." And then the camera goes, whoop.
Right. And then it was almost like he flashed, like he pulled it out of his
absolutely.
Zipper.
Absolutely.
And then they were just dumping fans, which is, that's the worst thing you could do. Like it's not only did they do this crazy trade, but they don't seem to understand like how angry it's made people. And they don't really seem that interested in quelling the anger. It's like they're taking gasoline and pouring it on the fire.
You get escorted out of the arena for saying fire Nico, for saying fire the GM. Are they going to escort the sports writers out of press row who wrote the same thing? I mean, why is that not a valid opinion?
Well, the other weird thing, and this kind of speaks to the incompetence behind the trade. How did they not anticipate any of this? Like they're in Dallas. Like Nico Harrison has been involved with the Mavericks longer than the owner. But he's there. He sees how popular Luka is. You go to any Mavericks game, it's Luka jerseys everywhere. I mean, I would say it's a top four fans wearing the jersey of the best player NBA city. It's just it's just everywhere. And little kids everywhere, 77, just everywhere. There was a couple when I was going to the finals, there was a couple Dirks, a couple old school Mav stuff. But for the most part, it's just Luka. It's like a fucking Luka army. This was their guy. They've had him since he was 18. They thought they were going to have him until he was 40. So to not anticipate that part of it is like, man, I really think this makes us slightly better. But my life is going to suck for the rest of the time I live here. Just that alone. And then you have Pelinka on the other end going, yeah, we got to keep this quiet. Nobody can find out. Because he knows the moment it leaks out, the Mavs fans are going to basically riot. I've never seen anything like this from a hubris / lack of awareness dating back, unless you go back to like the 80s when the league was, you know, everyone was on cocaine and the league was fucking crazy and the teams were worth $12 million and weird shit happened. This is like out of the 80s.
Yeah. And how about Jason Kidd? No post-game presser last night. Wasn't that great?
Everyone was saying this is like never happened before with any Mavs team. We've never seen a coach just skip the presser. We're taping this at, it's 10 o'clock PT. We might find out today Davis is out for like 2 months.
Yeah. I mean, that was also kind of a news dump during the Super Bowl too. Oh, wait, AD is actually hurt. I mean, you say like he didn't anticipate it, but I feel like he did to some extent because I feel like the secrecy was driven by Pelinka, as you say, so there were no other offers, no other suitors. But I think Harrison kept it quiet too because he didn't want to face the backlash. He knew it would get crushed. So in the way, like you were kind of anticipating it, but maybe not anticipating how big it would be.
Right. Well, this has, I mean, the Patrick Dumont piece of this.
Oh my God.
As it's evolved. I wrote down the funniest outcomes of the Luka trade so far.
Here we go.
And it's a long list. Everyone made this point, but a trade so bad, people thought Shams got hacked. Let's just start there. That's never happened before in the history of professional sports where we assumed the best reporter of a sport got hacked. Pelinka dressing like a Fast and Furious villain for the post-trade conference, I loved. Just like decked out, like he was about to do a concert in New Zealand with it. Like he used to be on New Kids on the Block and now he's got a solo career. I love this one. Everyone's still pretending that Jason Kidd, JJ Redick, LeBron, Rich Paul, and Anthony Davis didn't know about the trade. Mm. This is my favorite. They're still doing it. It's like, this is like Playhouse Theater. If people think Jason Kidd didn't know about this trade, I got like a bridge to sell you. It's unbelievable that they're still pushing this. AD, have we talked about this the day after the trade, like, AD waived his trade kicker and gave up $5.9 million in like 40 minutes to make the trade work. There's no way he didn't know. It's impossible. He has this huge house out here in LA. He loved being on the Lakers. He had to have known. All these people knew and they're still doing it all these days later. Well, it was so important. We had to just keep it between the owners and Nico and Rob, and that was all. It couldn't get out. Why couldn't it get out? Why? Because you knew the Mavericks fans were going to fucking riot if it got out, because it was so fucking stupid. That's why I couldn't get out.
Totally. They tried to square the circle at that Nico press conference, which was also one of the great moments in this whole thing, where he said, J-Kid didn't know, but we were aligned on the vision.
Right. Well, but then they said he didn't know to the 11th hour. Mm. It's like, you mean the 11th hour of a 24-hour day? Because there's no fucking way you traded Luka without telling Jason Kidd and talking him through it. Like, first of all, that's insane. If you're running a basketball team and you're not going to walk through all the mechanics of here's door A and here's door B. And also, like, they were complaining about Luka behind the scenes for like 2 years. Oh, and there's no way Jason Kidd wasn't a huge part of this trade. And by the way, Jason Kidd, not exactly the most stand-up dude over the years. Like, this is the guy who stabbed Brooklyn in the back so he could get the Milwaukee job. Like, he's left a trail of bodies everywhere. And they, like, the Nets in 2007, all of a sudden he got out of there. Like, this is not like Mr. Loyal, awesome team employee guy. So I just, give me a break on that. And then LeBron, like, the way he reacted to the trade after, like, if they really blindsided on this, there's no way that he reacts the way he did, which was like, oh yeah, well, wait and see. I just think everybody knew this was better. This was a better situation for LeBron. It actually gave him a chance to win a title. It was better for AD to go to Dallas. Anyway, that was one of my favorites. We mentioned Nico saying they kept the trade talks quiet because neither side wanted it to leak. You mean you didn't want it to leak, because the moment it got out, there's no way the fan base would have let you do it. Patrick DeMonts' interview over the weekend.
Incredible.
When he said Kobe was a culture builder.
Mm-hmm.
And even though Kobe's coach in 2005 wrote an entire book about how awful it was to coach Kobe.
And and Shaq was the guy who was always in shape.
Shaq's work ethic, which was like the most famous thing about Shaq. In my book of basketball, the whole thing I wrote about Shaq was that Shaq could have graduated with a 4.0 and instead he graduated with a 3.7 and had a great time. Like, that was Shaq. Mark Cuban, a week late, doing the whole, I tried to stop it as soon as I found out, but it was too late, because he probably was walking around for a week with everybody just crushing him on the trade. And finally he had to like get some piece out to Mark Stein, like, hey, can you put out that I had nothing to do with this? Like, there's really no blood on my hands. The Mavs trading Luka because he couldn't stay in shape and was always an injury risk. But then they got Anthony Davis, who got hurt in the first game. Like, you can't make this up.
Somebody whose nickname is Street Clothes.
Right. It's like, this guy's better. Who knows that Dave McBenneman story yesterday, when it was like LeBron's camp has noticed that Luka got what he wanted right away.
That was an amazing sentence.
And LeBron has been pushing for this stuff for years. First of all, LeBron's played with, just in the last 14 years, Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh, Kyrie Irving, Kevin Love, Anthony Davis, and Luka Doncic. He plays on a Lakers team. When they traded for AD, they traded two top two lottery picks, Brandon Ingram and Lonzo Ball. They pushed Julius Randle out, who is another lottery pick. They traded the number four pick that became DeAndre Hunter. They put Josh Hart in the trade. They put Mo Wagner in the trade. They traded like two more swaps and picks, including the one that became Dyson Daniels. And they have another pick this year. Like, they gave away like basically a decade of drafts combined with the two Westbrook trades. Then how much can you do for this guy? So I almost don't believe that he couldn't have. There's no way he really feels like they're not doing enough for him. Anyway, that made me laugh. And then all the Mav stuff with just, hey, let's hold our heads high and thank Luka for his 7 years. And he brought us to the Western Finals and the Finals. And this was great, Maverick. Good luck in L.A. No, they did the opposite. They just leaked shit left and right. He's a fat piece of shit. Maybe he had a drinking problem. His calves could explode. Watch out for his Achilles. There's so many fucking things that are leaking out. It's disgusting.
It was. And you know me, I'm a student of the Now They Tell Us story. And just right. As soon as this trade came down, we were all on the clock, right? You guys even said it on the emergency podcast that night.
Here we go.
On the clock. Here we go. But it never really came out, because there's really not a reason for this, right? There's not a great answer. There's always an answer with these things, with these weird stories. What happened? What are the motives here? And the answer is, it was Nico Harrison. Like, he didn't have a good reason. He just did it.
Right.
He did this stupid, incredibly stupid thing.
Well, and then Dumont, the owner or the guy who's running stuff. The more I talk to people and I keep looking for conspiracy theories or whatever, and it just seems like they just felt like they didn't like that he wasn't in shape and they thought he was kind of a dick. And that just seems like that's why. They didn't want to give him $350 million. This is the all-time new owner syndrome trade we've ever had. We've had so many great ones over the years where somebody takes over a team and within a couple months they're like, here's my idea. And it's usually a disaster. This is the worst one ever.
Yes, but usually you're paying too much for another star, right? That's the new owner syndrome. That's the Nets. That's the Suns, right? You're going out like, let's go get an aging star and spend way too much capital to go get that guy. This is the opposite.
It's the opposite, but the spirit is always the same. It's always somebody moving into the league who's had some success somewhere else or inherited the success he had. And they go in and within a year, they think they're smarter than everybody else. And that's always the North Star where they come in and they're like, they're just trying to do a zag, right? They're not like, I just want to come in. I want to learn this business for 3 or 4 years. Trust the people that are in here. I want to be a student of the game. There's a lot of stuff I don't know yet. It's always more like the Ishbia thing where it's like, nope. Everybody's doing this, so I'm going to do this. Like Prokhorov was another classic in Brooklyn, right? He's just like, picks, what are those? Spend those. And then a year later, he's like, yeah, cut costs. That was stupid. And then he just demolishes the Nets for, you know, a decade. But they all have to do it. Even Ballmer, who I think was one of the better new owners. But Ballmer, he took over. And, you know, within a couple of years, they had traded Blake Griffin, Chris Paul was out, like, and that was probably one of the more successful ones, but they all have to do it.
You know what really pisses me off about this is, and this is like comes from a more personal place, is that you and I, before we worked together, both worked with people in our lives who would make our lives hell. And it wasn't that we had like, I care about journalism, you care about journalism intensely, and we're just butting heads over the particular vision. We would look at them and be like, you actually don't care that much.
Yeah.
You just like having a job.
Right.
And when you don't have this job anymore, you're going to go off and do another job. And you're never going to think about this again. And I'm going to think about this for the rest of my life, this moment.
Yeah.
Because I'm so pissed off. That's Maverick fans to me. Nico Harrison's going to do a couple more years of GM and then he's going to never do this job again. And he won't think about this as, oh, that was a great failure in my life. He's like, oh, that was weird. You know? Couple of weird years in my career. Now I'm going to go work with my buddy Rob again. And, you know, it just doesn't matter. And Patrick
and
Dumont, it'll move.
It'll be out of Texas.
Patrick Dumont will never think about this again. And I just guarantee it. And that is what's just particularly galling about this whole deal to me.
Well, and also that Patrick Dumont clearly was not a huge basketball fan probably until the last 6 or 7 years, based on that one interview he gave. There's wrinkles to this that I think tie into where basketball is kind of moving anyway. And I've noticed it with my friends' kids, especially kids, maybe my son's age and under, where they root for the player over the team. I think video games have something to do with this. I think all the player movement has stuff to do with this. I also just think basketball's different. Guys jump around now, so it's easier to just grab a player than a team. But it's definitely one of the player empowerment LeBron generation. This is one of the side effects. It's like, I like Russell Westbrook. Now he's on the Nuggets. So now I'm a Nuggets fan. This Luka thing is the most interesting test case for this because I know of a few people who either it's them specifically, their kids, or people they know who are like, my kid's a Laker fan now. Like, this is it. Like, we've actually given up on the Mavericks. He's just going to follow Luka to the Lakers. He's going to root for the Lakers from now on. I don't remember a bigger version of this in any sport. Like when Brady went to the Bucks, the Pats fans, we rooted for him. Like I rooted for him during the Super Bowl, but I was never like, I'm now a Bucks fan. Like we stayed the Pats fan. This is actually like, it feels like they've lost fans over this, which I don't remember happening.
It's really fascinating because I'm like you. I have my teams that I've had since childhood and it never changed. I never
acquired family.
Like a second NBA team or a second, like that's bullshit. Get out of here with that. This is the one time I wouldn't blame anybody for doing it. I mean, Dirk sitting there blessing the whole thing last night with, you know, and Luka doing the Dirk trademark shot. Dirk, by the way, greatest player in Mavs history. who, after he won a title, did a Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives tour. I mean, right. Staying in shape. Remember right. that?
Yeah.
I mean, so I wouldn't blame anybody if you're just a Luka fan. And now, even with all the changes you talk about, with what the Mavericks did, why not? Why wouldn't you just keep rooting for him no matter where he's playing?
The other thing I was thinking about, just from a historical standpoint with this trade, which speaks to the fact that they had a sports business executive who doesn't seem like he was a true basketball fan, Nico. Maybe he is, but it's just like his lack of understanding of the history of this stuff was really notable. And then Dumont, who clearly isn't a basketball fan. But there's been so many great players who hit kind of this weird inflection point that Luka seemed to be in, right? Where he's 25, he wasn't at his all-time peak yet. You could talk yourself into, yeah, maybe this is never going to happen. And ironically, the Mavericks had one of those guys in Dirk Nowitzki. When they made the finals with them in 06, the MVP season in 07, and then they lose to the Warriors in round one. And then around 08, it really seemed to go sideways, and he had some issues. He got involved with a woman that became a thing where he had this bad relationship. And 08-09, you really felt like Dirk was gettable and that the ship had sailed on him being an awesome player. And they didn't trade with him. Cuban was like, I'm never trading this guy. Cuban had a chance to trade him in 04 for Shaq. That was when Shaq became available. It was like the obvious trade was Dirk for Shaq. He's like, I'm not trading Dirk. Dirk's our guy. And they just kept him. But there's been other guys over the years when teams have blinked, when they've had, they're like, should we trade him? Especially when you go back to the 70s and 80s. This is the first time in a while a team blinked.
Yeah.
Even Minnesota with KG, like they never traded him. The Wizards did it with C-Web, but C-Web like never had any real success. Luka had real success. He made the finals last year, did the Western finals. Like he was actually winning shit. So this is why I think one of the many reasons, I was even going back, I was reading Houston and Hakeem Olajuwon, because in 92 and 93, and you can read, there's a ton of stuff about this. Like he almost got traded to the Clippers. He was being shopped around. There was a Reggie Lewis possible trade at one point. But they never traded him. They kept him. So this happened before, but this is the rare time where the team just blinked.
And it's so early to blink. It's so early. I mean, 29-year-old Luka, maybe you never get back to the finals. You got to the Western Conference Finals one more time.
Right.
Then you
trade him for 7 first-round picks and some 22-year-old. That's the only way it makes sense.
Yeah, and he has like 2 seasons in there where he plays like 45 games, and then you're starting long-term conditioning, whatever. But this is way too early to even entertain that idea.
The other piece of this trade, which I'm happy to go on the record, and people can clip this out and shove it in my face for the rest of my life. I'm far more.
Aggregate this, everybody.
Aggregate
Here we go.
This right now. I really think this is the greatest thing they ever could have done for him.
For Luka.
Professionally, career-wise.
Oh, yeah.
Motivation-wise. This is the all-time we did you a favor by doing this trade. I already thought he was going to win a title someday. To me, he was the natural pick of anyone under 27 for who was going to win. All of the checkpoints that he's hit as a player. But the one thing that was kind of missing was like, guy's carrying too much weight. Like if you go back and you watch him rookie year, second year, he's just way skinnier and he's more explosive, right? He added all this weight because it made him harder to deal with. It made him more physical. It added a post-up game. But, now I wonder what, between that, some of the stuff we're already reading about LeBron and him kind of Luka in awe watching LeBron's workout. I mean, LeBron's like one of the most legendary workout guys ever. And Luka kind of, maybe finally understanding this is maybe what it takes. Usually this happens when somebody's on the U.S. Olympic team. But Luka's Slovenian. Like he never was in that wing. Where it's like, and you always have these stories like that. It's 92 had it, 2008 had it, where they're watching the best player and they're like, holy shit, that guy's getting up at 5:30 in the morning to work out. Maybe I should start doing that. And so anyway, I just feel like that's the frustrating thing for me as a Laker hater, that this is just clearly the greatest thing. Plus, everyone comes to California and loses 20 pounds. It's the other thing. So he's like, that's just not going to happen anyway. Bill.
No, I agree. And sometimes the psychology with players is like deceptively simple. We're talking about Mahomes, what he's going to think about all year.
Yeah.
And every time there's a clip on ESPN, look at that. Look at that. Brady, you know, fed off that his entire career. So just imagine Luka. Read all those stories about being overweight. Team didn't believe in me.
They thought his Achilles was going to explode.
Thought his Achilles
was going
to
explode.
That
was my new favorite one in the last week. Ah, his Achilles. It's ticking time bomb. Oh, okay. Cool. Can you walk us through how this plays out in Dallas with your lifelong knowledge, appreciation, historical sense of things in Dallas? A trade that was being compared to the JFK assassination for its impact on the city. How does it play out from an animosity, anger? Just what are the next 4 months look like?
So here's what I would say. The Mavericks were created as a franchise in my lifetime. Like they were literally.
Right, 1981.
Or
1980,
To watch them, you had, other than that time they pushed the Lakers to 7 games in the Western Conference Finals. Until the Dirk era, they were just barely a franchise. Barely rated on the Dallas sports consciousness. Way behind the Rangers, for second place, by the way.
And it felt like in the 90s, they were one of the NBA train wreck franchises.
Absolutely.
One of the three worst.
People still said Clippers, but it was actually the Mavericks, except the Mavericks would just lose the draft lottery every year. Remember that they gave that 76ers all-time wins record a ride a couple times. I mean, it was just unbelievably bad. And
I remember when they traded Jason Kidd too, it totally made sense because it was like, of course they did. They're fucking stupid. Of course they're going to trade him after 2 years.
Oh my God. Was that Sam Cassell and
whatever. It's like, we're not sure these three guys can mesh together. So we're going to trade the best one of the three. It was like, you guys are idiots.
Totally. And Cuban and Dirk made the Mavericks into a real franchise.
Yeah.
And then there was another period of, kind of weirdness there at the end where they kind of went, they were declining with Dirk. And then Luka made them again. Like, no matter what you say, Luka's here. There's a thing to talk about. There's a thing to pay attention to. There's a reason to buy a ticket to a Mavericks game and be excited and get into the Mavericks. And now I just wonder where they slide, on the sports consciousness. And even talking to those radio hosts, the same thing. It's like, what's the Mavericks segment we do? What do we do? Do we do an AD segments every week? I don't think so. I wouldn't. Let's say they get healthy and they're a playoff team this year. I mean, there'll be some interest. People will be in. But I just think
it's gonna be hard sliding. To make the
playoffs. You've seen this happen with Boston teams before where you just slide off the map for a while.
Happened with the Pats.
And in this case, it's not just because you're bad or potentially bad in a couple of years. It's because people are pissed at you. Like, they're angry with you. They think you just screwed them over in a way they've never felt before. And I just think there's a lot of potential there for them just slide into the ocean for a while.
Well, I mean, imagine if Kyrie leaves. So he can opt out. There's some free agency stuff with him potentially. Ooh. Like this could be a house of cards pretty quickly. And then the Davis piece of it, if he's just not healthy this year, like they have a real chance not to make the playoffs because the West is so good. I was looking at the odds. Like I bet when I was in Louisiana over the weekend, I bet on FanDuel, I bet on Golden State at like plus 155 to make the playoffs. They're plus 102. Tomorrow they might be plus 170. Like the West is like, depending on who wins 2 games in a row, there's 11 good teams plus San Antonio. There's 8 playoff spots. So if you have Davis out for a month combined with, Kyrie pulls something for a week, now all of a sudden you're sliding out of it. So fascinating stuff. Who thought Dallas would be this crazy as a sports city without the Cowboys being involved? I think that might have been the biggest shocker of all of it.
Oh my God! And I tell you, the words Brian Schottenheimer have not been uttered once on Dallas Sports Radio.
or Jerry Jones possibly winning an Emmy for Landman.
There we go.
The most emotional TV cameo of the last 5 years. Who knew?
Best thing he's done in 30 years by far.
Unbelievable stuff. Oh, I almost forgot to do this. So I was saying to you last night when we were texting that this was the first NBA trade that I felt could be turned into a Ryan Murphy limited series on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
Where, not to compare this trade to the Menendez brothers and Ted Bundy and some of the other things they've done.
But why not?
But it feels like, you have characters, you have intrigue. You have the Dumonts coming in as like the rich family screwing stuff up. You have Cuban as the old guy hanging on. you have Luca and his, like, whoever his entourage is and whatever, they could Ryan Murphy that character up and make people like, no, Luca, it's 3 a.m. You can't have Popeyes. You have LeBron and Rich Paul and AD and the Laker side and Jeannie Buss and Jay Moore. Somebody could, maybe Jay Moore plays himself. Anyway, I asked you to just go nuts with this.
Yeah. So opening scene of our limited series, it's got to be this coffee shop meeting between Nico and Rob Pelinka.
On January 7th, immortalized by a photo from some random weirdo in Dallas.
And did you hear the guy taking the photo was a Lakers fan? So he recognizes Pelinka, but he doesn't recognize Nico.
Oh.
Which is a great detail. So he snaps a photo. We see Bill, camera, push in. He's texting a friend and he goes, I just found Rob Pelinka having coffee with some guy. Which really sets
opening
the tone
credits. Boom. Let's go.
Yeah. Theme song, hard cut.
Boom.
Here we go.
Ryan Murphy's Luca trade.
And the only drawback there is, do we want Pelinka to walk away from the coffee meeting and pick up the phone and call somebody and be like, you'll never believe this.
Right.
You'll never believe what I just heard. We got this going on. Mark Cuban flashback.
Yeah.
Yelling at the refs, buying the team, selling the team.
Oh, yeah.
Kobe flashback, so we can see Pelinka and Nico meeting probably at Lakers games, right? Talking to each other.
So we're going back and forth like The Last Dance a little bit. Okay.
Yeah. And this is a limited series, right? We got to have, not everything has flashbacks these days.
Right.
I was playing with some casting here too. You got to help me with this. I mean, I'm just so sorry we lost Penny Marshall, because Miriam Adelson, I mean, that would have been the ultimate casting.
Maybe we can bring her back. CGI now is amazing. Maybe Penny Marshall's maybe it's not dead yet.
CGI Penny Marshall. Do we want Josh Gad for Patrick Dumont? I kind of like that a little bit.
Oh, that's really good. I mean, you could also go Chris Pratt putting the weight back on after losing the weight and getting muscular the last 12 years. Now he's going back trying to win an Emmy.
Who do we like for Cuban?
Cuban's like, it feels like Jeremy Strong in a zag. Nobody expecting Jeremy Strong here. He's got the Cuban wing on. He's super personable. And you're like, whoa, Jeremy Strong is Cuban? This is crazy. Why are they doing this?
He could be Pelinka too.
That's
because
better.
Because what if he's reading The Alchemist's Wife? No,
Rob Lowe has to be Pelinka. What are you talking about?
Okay. But they have to be quoting, from things and doing. Yeah. Either one of those guys I could see, actually.
Who else could be Cuban?
I had J.K.
Ben
Simmons.
Affleck? Could Ben Affleck be Cuban?
I had J.K. Simmons with a wig. And at first
that's
great. I was like, he's too old, but he's actually only 4 years older than Cuban.
Great. I like
their
that the most.
Faces look different, but we can work on that.
So J.K. Simmons, Nico Harrison could be 40 people. That's
Does anybody
easy.
Play Danny Ainge getting wind of this deal like with 30 minutes to go?
No, he plays himself.
Okay, Danny. We're going to cast Danny. Dirk was a tough one for me.
Dirk plays himself.
Okay. Luca?
You could also do the thing with Dirk where it's like a 6'4 actor with a bad Dirk wig and it's clearly not Dirk, because that's one of the staples of these shows where the guy doesn't actually follow sports.
Yeah. Somebody has to be completely ridiculous.
Yeah. That's probably Dirk. Dirk's like 6'2.
What do we do with Luca?
Luca's tough. This is where you get into like the Aaron Hernandez show, which I liked. And the guy didn't really look like Aaron Hernandez, but by the end of the show, you kind of felt like he was Aaron Hernandez. So you almost need somebody that's big and a little doughy, and that could be anybody. Maybe you're going with an unknown for that one.
Yeah. Do we need like a De Niro-style weight gain where we send him to Italy to eat pasta for like 3 months so they can
Too expensive in the budget. You have to pretend Italy. You have to pretend it's like Palos Verde.
I like this. Is actually a good series.
Yeah, this is pretty good. And I think the Dumont, the Adelson Dumont family, I think features prominently in this.
Yeah.
Just like, you really make Dumont like a villain and just a goofball who's like frantically trying to read up on NBA history. Like he's reading Halberstam Breaks of the Game. Somebody told me to read this. I don't know who any of these people are. He's just confused.
Can we still get Bill Walton in a trade?
Who's playing Skin and who are the Mavs radio guys? What are those guys?
You're talking about Ben and Skin. Yeah.
Ben and Skin. Who's playing Ben and Skin?
Oh, my God.
Those are great roles.
I would have so many ideas for Maverick Sports Radio. I mean, there'd be so many. This would be unbelievable.
Could people play me and Russillo and Mahoney doing the reaction pod, or are we playing ourselves?
Yeah, and Skip plays himself, too. Don't forget that, because he would have some big takes on this.
Skip with, like, some de-aging, like the Irishman. Because we go back into the mid-2000s when he's saying that you can't win a title with Dirk Nowitzki, then it's like current Skip.
Unbelievable.
Stephen A. actor, or sure. Stephen A. is himself?
He absolutely wants to play himself.
What about Donald Faison as Nico Harrison?
Ooh, interesting.
See, that'd be good. Yeah. I like All right, that. This is great. Ryan Murphy, get on it. Call us. We're ready to do this. Brian Curtis, you can read him on theringer.com, a great website. You can also listen to him on the Press Box. An awesome podcast. One of our, how many years for the Press Box been out? Eight?
I think it's eight. Yep.
I forced you to do it.
And I've never been more thankful.
No, you were receptive. I forced Fennessy. You were ready. Fennessy yeah. was forced. Fennessy took like, he was debating it like it was the Luka Doncic trade for weeks before he actually pulled the trigger.
He seems to have gotten the hang of it.
Yeah, he's doing all right. Curtis, thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
This episode is brought to you by Nissan. If you're planning on an adventurous 2025, you're going to need a car that can keep up with you and conquer anything in your path. The Nissan Armada Pro 4X is that car with a twin turbo V6 engine ready to propel your adventures up to 8,500 pounds of towing capacity to haul all your favorite toys and space for eight passengers. This unshakable fortress will chew up and spit out anything you throw at it. Learn more at the all-new 2025 Nissan Armada at NissanUSA.com. Towing capacity varies by configuration. See Nissan Towing Guide and Owner's Manual for additional information. Always secure cargo. All right, the one and only Matt Bellany is here. You can read him on Puck. You can listen to The Town, an awesome podcast. Some have credited him with Craig Horlbeck's rise as a media mogul. I think we can split credit.
I'd say the rewatchables. I'd say Craig's moment really was his 3-minute rant about risky business at the end of a rewatchables. That was the moment. That was the moment he became a star.
That was when he knew someday he could marry into the Adelson family and maybe run the Mavs. We just talked, Brian Curtis and I just talked about the Luka trade, and I was saying how the Ryan Murphy Luka trade miniseries on Netflix, I would just watch. And we had a whole bunch of casting stuff. Is there anybody just, without you knowing what we talked about, is there anybody that you feel like would have to be in that?
Well, did you discuss James Corden?
James Corden as Dumont?
No, James Corden as Luca. That's not a thing? I'm a passive observer here, but it seems like Corden is born to play the role.
I mean, honestly, Ryan Murphy would probably do that. Because Ryan Murphy clearly doesn't follow sports, as we've seen from some of his other stuff. So he could be like, yeah, we'll just cheat it and make him look like he's 6'8".
Well, yeah, that and Corden might have to lose a few pounds, but...
Or gain Luka, a few.
Luka might have to gain a few, but maybe we get Luka at one of his post-beer drinking sessions.
What's your Ryan Murphy miniseries that he hasn't done yet that you can't believe he hasn't done yet?
I mean, is there a murder he hasn't exploited yet?
Is there a Simpson Bruckheimer one that, like, do you feel like there's an 80s Hollywood one that's sitting there for
him? Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer never really feuded. Don Simpson just sort of went off the rails, and they did end up splitting, but I don't know. I
mean, I'm not a big.
Who?
Ovitz, like the Mike Ovitz when he was the most powerful agent in Hollywood, and then
does
it went sad. Not interesting
about that?
Yeah. I don't know what's left.
It's if he does another Hollywood one, I mean, he could do the Harvey Weinstein story.
Ooh.
Like barreling through Hollywood in the 90s and 2000s, knowing what we know now about his downfall. Maybe he could do that.
The problem is with an idea like that is I don't know if I'd want to spend time. I felt the same way about the Donald Sterling show. Like ultimately, I just didn't want to spend 6 hours with Donald Sterling. Even if the show is good, there's like some limits I have for.
I get that. I mean, you could do the comedic version, although Harvey, you can't do comedy with.
No, you
like
can't.
This new Lakers show that Jeannie Buss made with Mindy Kaling on Netflix. Like they when I saw that they were that Netflix was doing a Jeannie Buss show, I just like winced. I was like, oh, no. but they went full comedy with it. Right. And that worked. I mean, I haven't watched it yet, but at least the trailer looks funny because it's just a total joke, the whole thing.
Yeah. SNL 50, one of the many reasons you're here.
Did you get the invite?
It's Sunday. I got the music invite. I didn't get the other one. It's what, 200 people?
It's 300 people in 8H, and it is turning out to be the toughest ticket I have ever seen in Hollywood. Like, ever. I don't know that there's even any sports equivalent of how exclusive this is. There are 300 seats. There are, I mean, hundreds of former cast members of the show, guest hosts, musical guests, executives that want in on this, friends of Lorne, Paul McCartney, all of them want into this thing.
Right.
There's no room. The overflow room is going to be a tough ticket.
So you have, I talked to John Hamm about it in the last week, and he said he's going. Right.
He's in.
So there's there's a guest host level where it's like Hanks, John Hamm, there's probably like 20, 25 of those.
And Hamm probably didn't tell you this, but he's probably only in because he's hot right now. Like he's, you know, after Landman, after Morning Show, after Fargo, like he's a hot actor right now. So he's in, but like there are probably some frequent guest hosts from the 80s and 90s that are not in because they are not cool anymore.
And then you have 50 seasons of cast. Some of them are dead.
Some of them
are. But a lot of them are alive from the 80s on. And it's like they're Eddie Murphy. But then like you get into like, is Piscopo one of the 300? I would think he has to be.
You'd think so. But remember at the 40th, there was a whole controversy over Victoria Jackson being in an overflow room. And she freaked out. So like the cuts are going to be tough. They're doing it right now, actually. I heard they're doing it today and tomorrow.
Oh, really? And then you have the music stuff because there's people like Paul Simon and
Friends
McCartney.
Of Lorne.
Yeah, Friends of Lorne. But then also bands like if Bono wants to be there, like he had one of the best music performances I've ever had. So he has to get in there. So I don't know how they do it.
Taylor and Travis, they got to be there. I mean, you just go down the list of people that are either super famous and just nobody ever says no to them, or they're friends of Lorne, or they're important to the show. Like, I can't even imagine. I would not wish this on anybody to have to pick that room.
Nobody has a plus one, I'm guessing.
Oh, hell no. No, there is not going to be an extraneous person in that room.
So
maybe the CEO of Comcast. Maybe his wife comes.
Well, that's the other thing. You need the rich guy circles, and you need the network circles. You
Ted
need
Sarandos
NBC
told me
people.
He's going. The CEO of Netflix, and he has nothing to do with the show. He's just a fan, but he's powerful enough in Hollywood that he can get in.
Well, they had to invite him because he could have basically destroyed SNL the last 6 years by doing Friday Night SNL on Netflix, and he loved
could.
The show and he didn't.
And
he's never doing
rumor,
that.
Ted loves comedy so much. There's always the rumor that he will just decide to do a Friday night or a Sunday night version and just steal all the people from SNL. I think he has too much respect for Lorne to do that, but post Lorne, all bets are off.
I am positive that as long as Lorne is there, he's never doing that because he loves the show and he loves Lorne. But the moment Lorne leaves, I think Netflix just takes that entire corner.
And NBC will walk right into it because once Lorne leaves, they will start cost cutting on the show because it's hugely expensive for what it is. And Lorne has been able to beat them back, but they will start to cut costs and Ted will recognize it and he'll swoop in.
So you think like just the 300 people in this place, which is basically like having the NBA Finals game 7 in an arena that has 900 seats. You think they've been planning this for like 6 months and they started out with a list of like 2,000 names and
six
levels
years.
And
they started this after the 45th. I mean, this is the culmination of Lorne's life work. Like they have been planning this. Comcast is giving this the whole symphony treatment where every aspect of the company tries to promote this thing. They set this whole, you know, 3-day weekend thing with the music and then the documentary premieres and all this stuff around the live show. They've been building this thing up like it's bigger than a sporting event for TV. And they have Lorne, I guarantee you, has been thinking about every single person who will be in that room for more than a year.
And we do not think he's retiring after the year. I'm 99% sure he's not.
he has said he is not. He has said he's going to do the fade out thing where he slowly brings in people to help him with certain things, but he is the ultimate decider. And push comes to shove, he is in charge. We'll see.
How did you feel about the documentaries and all the stuff that they did to lead to this moment? And I have some thoughts on what it might mean to the culture too.
Because I only knew about the cowbell sketch from columns that you wrote 20 years ago.
Right.
Which caused me to check it out. I thought they were generally good, better than might be expected for promotional documentaries. The one with the old footage of their auditions, I thought that was super fun. I hadn't seen a lot of that stuff. The cowbell one was my favorite just because it was amazing. The season 11 one, like there, it raised a lot of questions to me that I don't think the documentary answered. They did a whole documentary just on this lost season where everybody kind of got fired at the end. And it was a little bit like you felt like one of those docs where they're not telling me the whole story here.
That was the most frustrating one to me.
Yeah. Lorne, huge flex, didn't even appear in any of the documentaries promoting his show. Right. They had to use archive footage of Lorne. Like, he didn't sit for his own documentaries.
The season 11 one I was so excited for because that's such a crazy stretch of the show where basically he leaves after year five. Ebersol comes in. The show is cratering and then Eddie Murphy saves it. They figure out a way to kind of keep Eddie Murphy, even though he's filming all the stuff in the first half of the show. They dole out the sketches to save it in season 9. And then season 10 becomes the all-star season with Billy Crystal, Martin Short, all those guys. And it's awesome. Season 10 is one of the best seasons in the history of the show. But then all those guys leave and Lorne comes back and Lorne tries to zag and hires all these young writers, or young actors, new writing staff, whole thing, and just misses. And I was like, they're doing a this sounds amazing, but it didn't dive into the Lorne stuff. It didn't really dive into why he came back, like the failure of the new show, which he had tried to do where he owned it. He almost went bankrupt from the show.
Right.
And basically took the job because he needed the money. Yeah. And the Dick Ebersol thing where he was so mad that Dick Ebersol was being considered successful with the show. And that's a really fun dynamic, those two.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Ebersol is still alive. Apparently, he's not doing great. But that's another mystery is, will he show up at the 50th?
He has to be there. He saved the show. The show's dead.
You know what? You would think so. But I don't know how well he's doing these days. And I don't know what the state of that relationship with Lorne is. I don't think they are close. It may be a respect thing that he invites him. But I don't know if he'll be there. The season 11 thing is amazing. I actually didn't know about that whole thing where they ended the season on a cliffhanger of firing all the
right
cast.
And just kept, and he pulls Lovitz out. Lovitz is the only one. That's the other funny thing is Lovitz was the breakout star of that season, which tells you about the season.
It's amazing. And you can imagine if they did that today. It's just like, yeah, so much happened on SNL in the 80s and 90s where if it happened during the social media era, it would be gigantic. And it just kind of came and went at 10 to 1 in the morning. And maybe people talked about it the next day. Maybe there was a newspaper article and then it was on to the next.
I think when they did this for SNL 40 and we blew it, it was my last year at Grantland and we blew it out. We had a whole week. We did the March Madness bracket for people on the show. We did an awesome job. You can go back and read it for people listening. We had like 20 pieces. I wrote a piece right after the SNL 40 show, which was 3 hours. And I think the headline was like, bloated SNL 40 was actually kind of perfect because that's what the show was. But the 40-year mark was really cool because the show was still really good, really relevant, and still really, really good at breaking stars. And it just come off that awesome cast with Hader and Sandberg and Sudeikis and Will Forte and Armisen and Kristen Wiig. And you look back at that cast, and you're like, holy shit. Like, we didn't even realize in the moment how loaded these, all of them went on to do all these other things. And the last 10 years, they just haven't had the same success with the cast. And I think that's what's different. I look at these last 10 years, and it's like, there's really no breakout stars that they've developed. Kate McKinnon was probably the last one, and she's not somebody who can carry her own thing. She's good as, like, being part of something. But that's what's changed in the last 10 years, I think.
Yeah, and I think that coincides with the rise of TikTok and online comedy and things that have sort of
right.
put SNL in the rear view. Also, COVID didn't help. A live show like that, that depends on spontaneity, like those were rough years. They've also, the cast has gotten too big. And I think Lauren would probably admit that. They just have too many people. He lets them go off and do other things during the season now. Where, like, if you look at someone like Bowen Yang, who they tried to make a star and didn't really work out, like, they had a show 2 weeks ago, and he was in LA on the Thursday before the show announcing the Oscar nominations. And then he gets on a plane and he goes back to SNL for the show on Saturday night. And then on Sunday, he was at Sundance promoting a movie that he had done. So, like, is Bowen Yang even part of that cast? Part of the whole SNL ethos is that you're there all the time. You're pitching, you're writing, you're coming up with bits. I mean, he was in and out of New York during that week doing his other projects and is sort of like kind of on the show. Like,
it's just
a different thing now than when you had these tight 10-person casts that had an identity to them. Now it's like sort of a revolving door.
Yeah, the only times they really did that over the course of the show, like Belushi was filming, he was filming 1941, I think in season 4 and flying back and forth. Eddie Murphy was doing movies when he was there. You made exceptions for like the major stars. It seems like they've made a lot more exceptions in recent years.
Yeah, Will Ferrell did a couple things, but like when Will Ferrell decided to be a movie star, he left SNL. Adam Sandler left SNL. Like it was a thing. Someone like AD Bryant had a Hulu show that was greenlit, aired, and was canceled all while she was on SNL.
Right.
Well, like, she had this whole side career going.
The thing you said about the cast, one of the great moments of this podcast when I was at ESPN was I got to interview Lauren in his office, which was, you know,
an incredible career
move for me. Career moment. It was just like, I can't believe I'm doing this. I had so many questions to ask him. I got to talk to him for an hour 20.
Did he offer you popcorn?
I don't think he offered me popcorn. Maybe he might have. But I talked to him about the cast thing. And I talked to him about my theory about how the cast was like a basketball team and you had to have the starting five and the four or five people off the bench. But once you have 17 people, you know, it's just too hard to get everyone involved. And he was explaining why he did it. And the reasons actually made sense, where he was like, some people aren't ready for the first year or the second year. It really takes until year three that you got to develop people behind them. I think the thing they really fucked up in the last 10 years was using these celebrities for big parts. And I've said this before, not being able to break new stars with parts like Biden, Trump, these things. If you go back to the history of the show, the cast members were always playing the people in the zeitgeist. And they shifted away from that and started giving those parts to these other people. They even did it in 24, like Maya Rudolph as Kamala Harris. Like, why can't that be a cast member? You know? And I think that's what shifted.
Alec Baldwin killed SNL.
Well, yeah, I think the theory of using people like Alec Baldwin, I think, was a huge mistake. I know
it's a drug. It's like heroin. It worked really well. People loved it. Lauren got the zeitgeist back for these big stunty moments. He started to get news articles out of who was playing who on SNL. And we saw it during 2015, 2016 with the whole Trump White House and Melissa McCarthy coming in to play Sean Spicer, Matt Damon doing Kavanaugh. Like, all that stuff was so alluring to them that they kind of got addicted to it. And it was like a drug. You get a high off it, but there's a definite downside. And the downside is the show itself suffers. And the people that are on there for 4 or 5 years, you don't even know who they are.
Right. And I remember right around when it started, Will Ferrell used to do that Janet Reno dance party sketch.
Mm-hmm.
And then
wouldn't happen today.
Would not. It was. I think that sketch is canceled. But Janet Reno came on.
Right.
If I remember.
Yeah.
And it was right at early 2000s, they started bringing the people there parroting on. The show was really, the show would go for it with celebrities. It was really mean-spirited in a way that I used to love and my friends all loved in the 90s. I mean,
you look back at some of those David Spade monologues, like, those would never happen today. The entire culture of celebrity has changed, where if you do that stuff now, you have to expect that you will get blowback from those people. And some of the, they court those celebrities so much now that they can't parody them. Like, who are the two most famous people in American culture right now? I think I've said this either on The Town or I forget where before, but Taylor and Travis. SNL should be going after Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce relentlessly.
Having fun parodying, with it, but going after them. Totally, yeah, I agree.
Totally going after them. But no, they don't, because they want them to come
on
the show.
How about Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni? How is that not like a talk show where they hate each other and they're next to each other?
I know. It's the thing that everybody in the culture is happening. But Blake is married to Ryan. Ryan has a lot of friends. They're in the Taylor Swift universe.
But that's happened. That's the biggest thing that's happened to the show this century over the last 20 years. And I remember when Tina Fey came on as Palin all those times, and then they brought Palin on. And you talked about it, it's like a drug. They get addicted to the crowd reaction. And then that became like, we're going to have fun with these celebrities, but we also need the celebrities. I remember when Andy Samberg did that Mark Wahlberg sketch. Hey, how's your brother? How's your mother? And it was really funny. And Mark Wahlberg got pissed. And they ended up bringing him on the next week to kind of give Samberg shit. And it was like, this isn't the show. The show was like kind of mean and ruthless sometimes with celebs. And now it seems like it courts the celebrities in a completely different way, which I just think is a product of Lauren being an older guy who just, he's a celebrity himself. And that's how
he's
he sees
establishment.
It. Yeah.
The show was counterculture and then it became the culture. And now it's sort of, it's ripe for disruption, to be honest. And you could argue that everything online and TikTok and everything has disrupted it, but
no.
It is ripe for something online. You know, in Living Color sort of did it. You know, Lauren had a huge blind spot with diverse people, with Black people in particular on the show.
Yeah.
And then in Living Color comes on, taking Damon Wayans, who was on the show and famously was fired. They disrupted them in the 90s and had a thing going. And I think that was the last time that someone directly took on SNL and won, and not beat them, but had their own success. There is a version of SNL for today's audience that would work, I think, and it's beyond something that's on TikTok. You could say that TikTok is SNL for today's audience, but there's something in a format, in an hour and a half format, that would work, and is just, SNL's just sitting there like a buffalo wandering the Serengeti.
I can't believe it hasn't happened yet. No, it's like, if Netflix had done this 2 years ago on Friday nights, I think SNL would have been in real trouble. They would have gotten the jump on them. The other way to beat SNL that nobody is, like, SNL just goes away from mid-May to, you know, late September. And every 4 years you have a political election. That's the most fun part to parody.
Yeah.
And like Netflix could have just launched a Friday night SNL show last May.
Yeah.
And just crushed it for 4 months. And by the time SNL came back, it would have felt like a dinosaur.
Yeah. So call it like a, you know, summer stock, or do it as a stunt in the summer.
Yeah.
And then you don't even have to compete with SNL. And all of a sudden you've got the political conventions. You've got all the campaign stuff to yourself.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is an incredible run. The fact that it's been on for 50 years and my entire life. And I remember all the pieces of it, but
it is amazing. There's nothing like it.
Especially like the music, which I was really glad they did that music documentary, even though I thought they missed a couple of things that I was just stunned by. But I was always one of my favorite underrated things about the show was just catching all these acts at the greatest time of their career, right as they're about to do this. And they would just over and over again get these people. And then sometimes, you know, it would just go the other way. This was it. That was the highlight. And then it was gone. I can't wait to see what happens Sunday night. I mean, it's one of the last must-see 8 p.m. network shows that's not sports or not an award show that we're probably ever going to have, right?
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. FanDuel line, who opens the show?
Do they go music or sketch would be my first question.
I think they will do a traditional cold open.
All right, so if they asked me, I would have the four or five best people in the history of show on stage together.
Oh, I do not think they will do that because...
I don't think they would either.
Because all that does is beg the question of who is the best ever? And that's a question that Lauren does
but
not want
to
answer.
But a couple of them are dead, though, so that makes it, you know, it's sad to say, but it's a little easier. But you take one person from each era. You take Aykroyd, you take Eddie, you take somebody from the Hartman era. Maybe it's Dana Carvey. You have Will Ferrell. You have maybe Kristen Wiig.
Maybe.
And it's like the
Hader,
five.
Sudeikis.
Maybe Hader. No, but I'm saying you have like five or six to start. I think they're going to go with celebrities, though, to start. It'll be like Tom Hanks, Paul Simon. It'll be like the Five Timers Club, basically. Something like that would be my guess.
Maybe. Here's an option. What if they do an original sketch with the surviving originals from the 1975 cast?
So Chevy's still alive. Jane Curtin's still alive.
Dan, Lorraine Newman, Jane Curtin.
Garrett Morris is still alive.
Yeah. So there's five of them still alive. And I believe they'll all be there.
Pretty risky. Some of them are like in their late 70s.
But that eliminates any political problems because you don't have to deal with people who think they were the best cast member ever. You don't have to deal with the Eddie Murphy issue. You don't have to deal with any of these other things. You just say, you know what? We're going to go with the five originals and then have something written for them. You know, Al Franken can write it, Donahoe, or someone like that. And then you start the show with the rest of it.
I feel like he's going to take the easy way out and just start with like Paul Simon.
Maybe.
Like performing with Paul McCartney and like they'll start out with some song with an awesome band and that kicks it off. And then Chevy Chase, I think has to start the show. Like officially be the one who like fall, they do some pratfall that they'll tape ahead of time and then it kicks to the credits would be my guess.
Yeah. Or here's another idea. What about something with Keenan? He's been on the show longer
show
than
for 28
else.
Years.
They could do a whole sketch around how
trips
long
Chevy.
Keenan's been there.
We're going to take a break and then I want to talk to you about some Hollywood stuff that's going on. All right. I love having Bellany on in mid-February because the Oscars is coming. It's usually just a fun time in general for Hollywood. We have the Oscars in about 2.5 weeks. Conan O'Brien's hosting. The movies are weird. Fantasy seems to be the only one who's happy with the movies. I just think Fantasy's happy with the movies every year. And then we've had some really advanced level negging of different movies that has hurt.
Are you aware of what's going on here?
I'm aware, but explain it to the audience.
It is sort of remarkable what is happening with the Oscars this year. The number one nominated film, 13 nominations for Emilia Perez, this Netflix movie about a transgender woman drug lord who has an adventure in Mexico. That movie has completely imploded over a Twitter scandal. So the favorite for Best Picture has basically been taken off the map for most of the nominations. Zoe Saldana could still win. They could still win Best Song. But this Twitter scandal involving Carla Sofia Gascon, who is the lead of the movie and just had some reprehensible old tweets that came up, has basically taken out the movie. And it is a 5-movie race now for Best Picture, and nobody knows what's going to win.
What do you think's going to win? What are you hearing? What's the buzz?
There is the indicators that we've seen so far that are pointing towards Anora, which would be a remarkable winner in its own right because it starts with about 45 minutes of hardcore sex.
I don't see
with a bunch of nudity in it. It's this like Cinderella story movie about a sex worker who dates this like Russian, well, not dates, is paid to date this Russian.
She dates drunk
kid.
Borat, drunk Russian Borat.
Drunk Russian 22-year-old Borat.
Yeah.
But
I don't see it winning. I don't think with people over 60, that first 45 minutes is going to work.
I would have thought that it would definitely be the most explicit movie to ever win Best Picture.
By far,
there's one X-rated movie, Midnight Cowboy, but that is pretty tame.
Which shouldn't have been rated X, yeah.
By today's standards. And
Coming Home gets pretty into it with the sex stuff.
And people forget, Brokeback Mountain did not actually win. Crash won that year.
Yeah, but, I didn't forget. one of the worst.
Yeah, Crash was amazing. The PGA, the Producers Guild, went for Anora. And those are a lot of older people, mostly men, but it's a lot of older people that I wouldn't have thought would have gone for Anora. I thought they'd go with Wicked. I thought they might go for A Complete Unknown, the Bob Dylan movie. The Directors Guild also went with Sean Baker for Anora.
I saw
those
that.
Are the only two real indicators so far of groups that overlap with the Oscar voters. This next weekend, we've got the SAG. No, this weekend, we've got the BAFTAs going on in London, which has a lot of overlap. There's a lot of foreign voters, so we'll see where they go. And then the SAG Awards after that are the indicators. But I think it's a 5-movie race between Anora, A Complete Unknown, Wicked, Conclave,
Wicked.
And...
Come on.
And then, you know, you got
it. The Brutalist has to be in there.
The Brutalist has to be in there. I mean, Brutalist is like, was the favorite a couple weeks ago, but everybody... I talk to like it's just polarizing. It's 3.5 hours. A lot of people don't finish it when they start watching it on the portal. They say, oh, I've seen it, but they don't actually finish it. The first half is better than the second half, but it's a real like cinista movie. And those movies are not benefited by the preferential voting system that the Oscar has, where you rank your choices. And then when a movie is eliminated, that person's second, third, fourth go get attributed to the other movies. So it's designed to build consensus among the voters. And I think consensus will benefit the broader movies, like The Complete Unknown or Wicked or something that is less polarizing.
That's Fantasy's theory for A Complete Unknown, which I don't think anyone thinks is a...
I do. Like, I'm on the record on The Town.
Best film?
It could be a shocker. It could be the shocker of Oscars, probably the biggest shocker.
No, some people are on the some people are on the record that it could win, but I don't think anybody thinks it was the best film of 2024.
Well, what is the best film? I mean,
I don't know.
This is
come
all
on.
Subjective.
It's pretty traditional.
I enjoyed it a lot. I thought it was a delightful afternoon.
I
liked
the performances. The performances were great.
The music's great.
The movie's fine.
Mean, you're watching, you're like, holy shit, these are all Bob Dylan songs. This is great. But I thought it was good. It's not like life-changing. It's just a pleasant time of the movies, and that to me that's enough.
I think it's gonna win. It's like 23-1. Yeah, because Fantasy was explaining that preferential treatment thing to me last week, and so these movies are too polarizing that are in there, and I just think the way the voting works, everyone's gonna have Complete Unknown in the top five. Maybe it's four, maybe it's three.
Agreed.
A couple people would be like, I liked it the most, it's my one, and it's just gonna kind of rack up votes. But it feels like, I thought Coda, we all bet on Coda, which we talked about. Like, that just seems the Oscar-y to me that year because the year was so confusing. And it was like, well, everybody liked this movie. Complete Unknown kind of feels
year.
Like, no, I get it. But Complete Unknown just feels, people like Chalamet. I could see it winning. Anyway, this thing I'm looking at now, it's like 23-1.
Yeah, and keep in mind, though, the Producers Guild uses preferential ballot, and that one went to Anora. So it can benefit there.
So do you think Chalamet wins as we head toward it?
That is the biggest question. It's Chalamet, Adrian Brody with Ralph Fiennes from Conclave as the dark horse.
Yeah.
And I honestly do think Chalamet is going to win. I think that what we saw last year with Emma Stone beating Lily Gladstone, Stone from Poor Things beating Lily Gladstone from Killers of the Flower Moon. I think that the voters, like, Hollywood is so desperate for young stars now.
Yeah.
Like, when there is someone that you can rally behind, people will go for it. Like, there's just, you know, Adrian Brody has an Oscar already. Ralph Fiennes, like, great actor, but like, is he the future of Hollywood? No. I just feel like Chalamet, he has sort of stumbled into this amazing career, and he's both box office bankable and a good actor. And sort of likable and like dates Kylie Jenner and is like a celebrity in the old school way.
Yeah.
I just feel like he's got the package people want to endorse, and it's the way to honor the movie.
And it would be the most fun speech.
Oh, for sure.
He's very well liked.
Are you kidding me? He'll thank his agent, his wife, and be off. You know, Chalamet, who knows what he'll do?
The shocking thing to me is, at least in the odds that I'm seeing, that Demi Moore is the favorite for The Substance over Mikey Madison, who I just thought Mikey Madison was a lock. That was the best performance I saw all year.
Yeah, but this is a career performance thing. Like,
I get
aren't you shocked? When I tell you that Demi Moore has never been nominated for an Oscar, doesn't that shock you?
I thought for About Last Night, she should have won.
Or Ghost. like Whoopi
you
wins.
You didn't even blink. I was kidding about last night. I do love her and about last night.
No, I mean, about
night,
last night is a, I mean, that's
be careful. It's a great movie. Be careful.
I honestly, I haven't seen it in probably 20 years. But
do you think the Emilia Perez lady would have won without all the stuff that happened? Was
probably
she the
not.
Favorite or no?
Demi Moore is a classic example of the Academy rallying around someone who is, it's not necessarily their best foot forward, but it's about time. And this person should have been nominated in the past. And it's about longevity. Like, she stuck it out and she got a movie role that was worthy of her. Finally, she gave a great speech at the Golden Globes, which I think was very strategic, talking about how she was not taken seriously and how she had to persevere. The movie itself is about this desire to be young and to be relevant and to stay in the mix. She has the whole narrative around her. And I honestly think a lot of Academy voters won't even watch the movie and will vote for her.
I like the movie, and I understand why they had to play the last half hour the way they did, but it was not a fun last half hour.
I think I think a lot of people will turn it off.
It's an excessive movie, to say the least, but it was memorable.
Yeah.
I would never watch it. It's not going to be in the rewatchables, I'll tell you that much. Conan O'Brien.
Mikey Madison, she's amazing, I would absolutely vote for her. If she doesn't win, it's because she's too new. She's not in Chalamet territory where she's a star and we want to endorse her. Like, she'll have her chance. It'll be the Austin Butler moment where he ended up losing to Brendan Fraser because Brendan Fraser had the narrative around him. He's a stalwart actor who's done good work, finally had a moment in a movie that mattered, and they gave him the Oscar. It'll be the same thing if Mikey Madison loses to Demi Moore.
It's tough when that was clearly the best performance of the year, other than maybe Chalamet.
Yeah,
like, for me, it was like the two performances that jumped out to me this year from everything I saw were those two.
I'll be a little controversial here. I thought Zoe Saldana in Emilia Perez was fantastic.
Mm.
Okay. Singing, dancing, playing that character. She's the lead of the movie. They put her in supporting because they thought Carla Gascon would be the lead and they'd have a chance to get her an Oscar there. But I think Zoe Saldana is amazing in that movie.
Baldoni versus Lively. Kendrick versus Drake. 2024 set up 2025. The year of the beef. We could talk about what other beefs we want, but this Justin Baldoni, Blake Lively thing is the kind of story that would happen in like the 80s and 90s, and you'd read like a Premiere magazine or Spy or Vanity Fair in 1994, some giant feature about it. And you'd just be like, what the hell is happening?
I know.
Now this story keeps going and going. Yeah. Well, in real time.
Now we're getting daily updates and they're setting up websites to attack each other. I mean, it is the difference between the Kendrick and Drake beef and this Baldoni gate that I'm calling it. There's a winner in the Kendrick Drake debate. And Kendrick won. I mean, very clearly he won the beef. I don't think there's a winner in Baldoni Blake.
Like, just they're losers.
They're both losers. They are both. I think Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively misplayed their hand here. They thought that they were going to go after this guy and they were just going to shut him down with this New York Times piece. And, you know, she was going to be able to get her reputation back because the stuff that came out during that press tour for It Ends With Us, it didn't hurt the movie. The movie grossed $300 million. That's the whole joke of this.
I think it actually helped the movie.
Hit.
Yeah.
They should have just like walked away, gone their separate ways and like let it lie.
It was the biggest movie she'd had in like 8 years.
Oh, brought her back. She was super hot after that.
She was doing like shark movies in the mid 2010s.
She was. But she did take a hit on the branding side because of some of the videos and things that came out. And they looked at that and they're like, this is bullshit. This guy is out there seeding the internet with negativity, they believe. And they went after him to try to get her name back. I don't think that that worked. I think that the long, drawn-out process here, keep in mind, Baldoni has a rich guy behind him, an investor in his company.
Like a Peter Thiel Gawker?
Not a situation? Peter Thiel style guy, but he's got, I forget his name, but he's got an investor in his company that is super wealthy and can afford to litigate against people like Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively. He's got this lawyer, Brian Friedman, who is an attack dog, and his specialty is fighting for people's reputations as well as their legal rights. So he's not going to lie down here and just let them run over him. They thought that they could go to the New York Times, get the Harvey Weinstein reporter to do this expose, and then he would bow down and probably settle and send, you know, give Blake Lively the rights to do a sequel to this movie, and he would go away. He's not going away. And they have just been slinging mud at each other, and I don't think either of them is benefiting.
Well, this is your background even before you got into what you're doing now.
I was a lawyer. I used to handle these cases.
Yeah. There's real defamation potential here that, the whole thing is you have to prove somebody had malicious intent with whatever they're doing. It can't be like, oh, I had this throwaway line on a podcast and then I shouldn't have said that. This is like malicious intent is the key. And it feels like there's malicious intent in this, which is what's so interesting.
There has to be actual malice is the standard, or reckless disregard for the truth. And the other element is it's got to be false. If it's just unflattering, it doesn't matter. It has to be false. And I think in many of these cases, the stuff that was resurfaced by Baldoni's team allegedly was old interviews of Blake Lively speaking in her own voice. So that's not false. It may be unflattering. And there's some other stuff that they say was false, but it's very unclear who would actually win if this case ever does go to trial, because the causation here, even if you're hiring shady characters to seed the internet with unflattering comments, is that actionable?
I was thinking more of the New York Times piece of it.
Oh, you mean what the New York Times published and whether that's defamation?
I think these two are a BS case. No, but
I don't believe that's real. I don't think New York Times would lose a defamation case for going with a story based on interviews with a subject and a legal proceeding that was actually filed.
Okay. Because it seemed like part of his case was they only took one side of this exchange.
Sure.
They had all access to all of this. They only decided to print this. And that got into interesting territory just reading about it. I was like, there's something.
Maybe.
I could see the case.
But again, the standard is whether the reporting was false.
Right.
Was it false? You could argue that it was slanted. You could argue that it may even be misleading if you don't include the full context of something. But does it rise to the level of defamation? And should the New York Times have known, and did they purposefully disregard certain facts in order to create a portrait of this guy that was false or misleading? During the discovery process, we will see what comes out. But from the complaint itself, I'm not convinced that Baldoni has a case against the Times.
So you think this is basically a nuclear war where both sides just blew each other up and there's no winners, there's no losers. It's not even a zero-sum game.
My advice to them both is settle now, go away for 6 months, and then come back. Like, do some settlement agreement where they agree to never say each other's names again. They will never be in the same room, and they can try to salvage their reputations afterward.
So Baldoni actually, by doing everything he's done, actually like was able to get an equal playing field again. Before this felt like he was going to end his career.
Depends on who you talk to. I think that his campaign has helped him after the New York Times piece. I mean, keep in mind, when that piece came out, his agency dropped him. He had a bunch of movies set up that went away. Like, that New York Times piece did actually hurt him a lot. So, understandably, he returned fire. The end result now, though, is that they are just like machine gunning each other from 10 feet away, and they're killing each other.
There's a Taylor Swift piece, too, that's kind of fun.
Oh, my God. I mean, do you believe that she's masterminding the whole thing?
I don't.
No. I do think that she probably encouraged it from the beginning. Everything that she has done in her career has been to stand up for herself, go on the offensive, you know, fight back. Especially if there's a guy who's been mistreating her in the public, she's going to fight back. And she probably said to Blake, fuck this guy. Go after him.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but Blake Lively has my wife and daughter's support because both of them have landed on, I don't like that guy's face as the reason to side on against Baldoni. So
I did enjoy that the paparazzi happened to see him on vacation with his family and happened to photograph him shirtless in a like beefcake pose. And those photos happened to be circulated about how he was spending time with his family on vacation. So that's it. The machinations going on here. That's the really interesting thing. It's just the whole underground PR world with these crisis people are fighting for the essentially the share of mindsets of people online. And that to me is a new world in crisis PR that is pretty fascinating.
And something you've been writing about and talking about for the last couple of years, some PR people who are just absolute barracudas.
Oh,
and
I know
some of them are in
involved
this.
Here.
Yeah.
The woman who repped him, Steph Jones, who also repped Tom Brady, has a bunch. I mean, she is just the worst. The worst. She slimed me. Like,
yeah.
The level of depravity of some of these crisis PR people is I mean, you think it's a low and then they go lower.
What was the best crisis PR TV show ever? A couple of people have taken swings at this.
Scandal. I mean, that was a lawyer, but Scandal was good. They had, remember there was the Courtney Cox one? That was the one
I was thinking of.
She was like an editor of like an Us Weekly type, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then Kendrick Drake, is that over? Do people care anymore? Is this going to be it, or is there like another level to this?
I mean, Drake's got to fight back, right? He's got an album.
I know, but it feels like it just keeps going and going. Does Hollywood care?
No, it's a music industry thing.
Okay,
but I think that people in the music industry definitely care. Certainly, Universal Music Group cares because they have both of them on their label, and they got sued by one of their own artists for defamation.
Right. That story is nuts. Where do you stand on
the NFL? Certainly cared. They wouldn't let him say pedophile on the Super Bowl.
They also stuck up for him, though. I think there were some lawsuits behind the scene that they kind of aligned with Kendrick.
Maybe. I mean, it's pretty remarkable that Super Bowl performance aired. Like, that is, it was openly political, you know, a diss track. That would have never aired on the Super Bowl 10 years ago.
Or about 4 years ago.
Maybe even 4 years ago. I just feel like that the fact that his fans loved it. I think there were probably a lot of like older, like white people in America who like didn't get it. Or
I could feel
like,
them in the Superdome.
Yeah, exactly.
You could feel
like
the
Donald
energy.
Trump
some people like, yeah.
Donald Trump not rocking along to
no,
the Kendrick set.
He was not.
But honestly, that's kind of great. Like, I kind of love that happened on the Super Bowl.
Speaking of Trump, Hollywood during the second Trump term,
very different
versus the first Trump term. What are the differences you're seeing early on here?
I think Hollywood is sort of in this weird place where people just don't know what's going on. The whole like vibe shift people talk about all the culture is changing and all these, you know, DEIs under attack and all the whole diversity movements under attack. Like Hollywood people are, I think, a little more cautious to speak out against Trump than they were the first time around, where the whole resistance movement and there was, he barely won. And, you know, there was this feeling of, you know, this guy squeaked into the White House and who is he and the chaos. Now that Trump has been more normalized, I feel like Hollywood is kind of figuring out how to respond. And you've got these big media companies that are like openly paying him off. I mean,
well, that's what my question is. Is there more fear of him this time around with some of the decisions big companies are making? Because it feels like there
totally,
is.
Totally. Totally. I mean, this is a president that's like purely transactional. It's what are you doing for me? And Disney, which had this open lawsuit with Trump over the George Stephanopoulos claims on GMA, they just said, you know what? It's not worth dealing with it. We're going to pay him $15 million, settle this. And if I'm Bob Iger, that's kind of an easy decision, because the last thing you want with this president is to have a politicized brand. Disney thrives on being a non-political brand, and it had been politicized by Trump and others. So just pay him off and he'll leave you alone. We saw today Disney put out a revise on their DEI initiatives to change their diversity language to more like talent focused, to kind of soften what they are doing in the diversity space. I think a lot of Hollywood companies are looking at Disney and what they're doing to see where they are going to go on this. They don't want to get sued by the Justice Department because they are looking to make shows with, you know, diverse people of color voices. They want to avoid any problems like that. And now we got this Paramount sale. Paramount, the studio is for sale. Actually, they have a deal. They're selling to David Ellison. And Trump is now threatening to hold that up based on the 60 Minutes interview with Kamala Harris on CBS, which he claims was biased. So there's a whole like dealing with Trump issue now in Hollywood that I think people don't really know how to deal with.
Yeah. And what happens, like what happens if he goes to Disney and he's just take him off the air? I'm just going to cause incredible amounts of trouble the next 4 years. Or what if he goes to Paramount and says, Colbert's got to go for me to even think about doing this. So all this would be bad for James Baby Doll Dixon, by the way. But
it would be. That's where I look at everything through the lens of, is this good or bad
What happens if he makes that part of the thing? And would somebody stand up to him, or would they be like, all right.
Something like that, where if the president said, I want you to fire Stephen Colbert, something like that, I think they would probably stand up against. But it's the more nuanced.
Are you sure?
I'm not sure. But
it's like you think like they pay $100 million a year for the show. It gets out, but it's like, oh, we were thinking about pushing my, like they could spin it a certain way.
They could, but Trump would probably brag about it. And then who's next? And then it's a purge.
Would you be surprised?
I would be surprised with that. I think if you're running a media company, you have to think bigger picture than that. And what's the implications for a move like that? Something like what Sherry Redstone is dealing with right now at Paramount, where Trump has this $20 billion lawsuit against CBS News over the Kamala Harris interview.
Yeah.
Everybody I have talked to in the legal world said it is a totally bullshit lawsuit. Would never win.
Yeah.
But Trump is doubling down. He's screaming about it on social media. So if you're Sherry Redstone and you can get rid of this by donating $20 million to the Trump Presidential Library, and it doesn't, and it takes away a threat to your $8 billion merger with Skydance that you want, I think that's an easy answer. You do that. You pay him $20 million and you make that go away. That's more likely the kinds of stuff that's going to go on.
Do you think the horrific fires and everything we're going through here in Southern California is going to change at all the way Hollywood thinks about Southern California thinks about Hollywood as a business? Because I always felt like it was shifting that, like so many people are filming stuff outside of LA and California because the tax breaks are so much better in Canada. You go to freaking South Africa, you go to Atlanta. And it always seemed like Miss Money. And I wonder, are they going to start thinking outside the box with stuff like that and maybe trying to bring people back?
I think they already are. I mean, there's this proposal in California to double the tax credits. And that was a Gavin Newsom thing that he put in place after the strikes. Because I mean, production was already really hurting in the area.
Oh, yeah.
And the strikes were awful. And they have this, you know, go up to about 700 and something million in tax credits, which would be good, but wouldn't change the calculus for most productions. I mean, they're shooting reality shows outside of California now because the economics are so much better.
It's
that Rob Lowe game show, the game show for people who can't read, that aired after the Super Bowl, that thing shoots, I believe, in Ireland because it's just cheaper to go there and fly all those people there. And that's what I think the movement now within the industry is, to try to use some of the momentum from the fires. I hate to use that word momentum when you're talking about fire aftermath, but there is this recognition that if they want the industry to come back in LA, there's going to need to be investment. So I think that there will be a state investment. I don't know about federal. I mean, you never know what Trump and them are going to do, but statewide, yes. And then some of these companies, you know, imagine the goodwill if Disney or Universal, one of these, said, you know what? Not only are we going to make 5 more movies in LA, but we're going to build a soundstage in Altadena, and it's going to employ, you know, 300 people and provide jobs that people don't have to go to Bulgaria for the summer to do their jobs in movies. And I think there'd be a lot of goodwill around that. You know, ultimately, push comes to shove, it's money. And if the economics make sense, they'll do it. But there is momentum now to at least make the economics better.
That's what I'm really hoping for. And I, you know, most people aren't going to care about this, but we both know so many people who you're making content and you're traveling to these crazy places and you're away from your family for 4 or 5 months. And it's just like, why are we doing it this way? Why aren't we filming as much stuff? You watch those TV shows and movies from the 70s and 80s and everything's in LA. And why can't we get back to that?
And this is not a new thing, but it has become more pronounced as the incentive to exit has gotten bigger. You shoot in the UK, it's like a 40% rebate on everything, on star salaries. Star salaries are currently excluded in California, so you can't get a rebate on paying Tom Cruise $20 million. But in the UK, UK, you can get 40% of that back. And, you know, like everybody I know is impacted. Lucas Shaw, my Monday guy on the town, his fiance is in Chicago for a bunch of months because they're shooting a show she's producing and they got credits to do it there.
I sat next to somebody at one of the Dodger playoff games. He's like, yeah, I'm about to go to South Africa filming this BET show. And I'm like, is it like set in South Africa? It's like, no, it's just cheaper to shoot there. I'm like, what? He had multiple kids. He's going away. It's just, they feel like they have to fix that. Meanwhile, the only people that have figured out business in LA is the Dodgers.
Oh, you noticed my hat.
We have to end on that. They've ruined baseball. They figured out how to make Japan the second revenue stream. They now own Japan and California. Baseball is no longer fun. You've ruined it completely.
All revenue streams that are readily available to any Major League Baseball team should they choose to invest in their own team.
It's too late now. It's basically like the Japan Dodgers is a wrap. You just get everybody now.
Listen, we'll see. You know, best laid plans. A lot of by the midseason, we might have five pitchers on the.
You feel good about this? Like, you really feel good about rigging the system like this?
I mean, as long as you can
sleep at night.
I get it. I get it that other teams are upset about this, but this is not they're not cheating. These are the rules.
You can do what
you want to do. And, you know, now that football's over, everybody in L.A., it's Mookie Betts season for everybody in L.A. except one guy, you.
This is what I would say if I rooted for the team that was ruining a professional sport in real time. I would say, hey, these are the rules. Sorry.
I get it. But we've won one championship. We won the 2020 championship in, you know, sort of booby prize fashion. It doesn't guarantee anything. And if the Dodgers want to pay that, they are making so much money by investing. Yes, they have a great local TV deal.
Yeah.
Yes, they have private equity owners that can structure these deals in a way that defers all this money and they can make that work. But this is not some system that is out of reach for most of these owners. They are choosing not to invest. And if your owner chooses not to invest, scream at your owner.
No, I'm not actually mad at the Dodgers. The Lakers are the team that makes me mad. And if you're like the Clippers and you've really thought outside the box, you build this awesome arena. There's finally a signs of the end with the Lakers, with LeBron hitting 40, and they don't have any draft picks left. Like, they're just going to suck. They're not very, you know, especially well run. It's like, here we go. We actually have a chance to maybe take this. It's way more fun to go to a Clipper game. And then
that arena's great.
In one dumb trade, the Lakers are back. Luka's going to be the guy now for the next 10 years and none of it matters. And Luka will be the biggest star in LA in basketball.
Do you think so?
I do. And there's no way for the Clippers to combat that. Like, Luka's...
So you don't subscribe to this whole theory that the NBA is suffering because Americans don't root for the foreign players like they do for the American players?
Well, they're about to, because Luka just went to their most important franchise.
Well, this is it.
But it's not even a test. He's going to be gigantically popular.
Do you think Luka can get to LeBron levels of fandom? I don't.
It's an interesting question. I think if it's going to happen, this is the team for it to happen. And if the trade can light the fire under him and make him truly great, and he can win like three titles in a row and average 30 a game and be the best guy in the league, like, yeah, that's going to happen. We would have said it wasn't going to happen with LeBron. There was a whole LeBron versus Kobe thing in 08, 09, 2010. He goes to Miami the first year. He sucks in the finals. It seemed like it wasn't going to happen for him. Like, you just never know. Luka has the talent.
I will defer to you on, you know, all things NBA, but I just have a hard time believing there's going to be appetite for Luca to star in a Space Jam sequel.
Yeah, but nobody saw the Space Jam sequel. It bombed.
Well, but he got it green lit. He got it green lit, and people were buying shows from him for a while.
And, yeah, and now they're not.
Steph Curry has a production company, and people think he's a media personality. I just don't know that the foreign players have as much cachet as the U.S.-born players.
We've talked about this many times on the pod. We have not seen it happen yet. I think if it doesn't happen in this case with a guy on the Lakers,
yeah,
you know, especially if he becomes really good. I still, like, anecdotally, just I'm sure you feel the same. Like, all the L.A. fans are going bonkers. Like, they can't believe. So this will be the test case. And I think this is the best possible guy for them to get.
It's funny. We're talking about the appeal of foreign players when who's the biggest star in L.A. right now? Shohei Ohtani.
Right.
And, like, no one seems to give a shit that he doesn't even speak English.
I know.
He does, but not very much. And, like, my kid, you know, has three Ohtani jerseys, like the freaking bobblehead night.
That's going to be Luka.
It was like the Beatles.
So let's end on this. Any LA celebrity, athlete, actor, musician, actress, you name it, walks into a restaurant right now in February 2025, who stops the restaurant the hardest?
Oh, Taylor Swift.
Okay, so she's clear number
one. She's clearly the number one most famous celebrity in the world.
The most, like, you're in mid-bite, and you're just like, oh my God, it's Taylor Swift. So she's one. So who's two?
Two is a tougher question. I mean, I think it's generational. If it's for you and me, Leo. Right?
Right. So you're saying 25 and under, maybe it's Chalamet.
Chalamet, maybe. Or Zendaya.
I don't think it's Chalamet. Oh, Zendaya's a good one.
Yeah. Or maybe a music star. Honestly, the music stars are just so much bigger.
There's no football star. I don't think Mahomes does it.
No, Mahomes is boring. And maybe someone like Selena Gomez for young people. She's just so immensely popular. And she means nothing to me. And I don't even really, like, I don't really get her as an actress. But for young people, she means a ton. Same with Zendaya. Beyond that, like, it's just so generational now. Tom Cruise. Probably the biggest movie star out there.
It's so funny that Taylor has this locked up in, like, a crazy, crazy, maybe nobody in the 21st century has locked it up like this.
Can you think of anyone else?
No.
I'd say probably most famous person in the world other than, like, the
Beyonce
Pope or Donald Trump.
Beyonce's second?
Beyonce's
number two.
Maybe. Beyonce's a huge star, but Beyonce doesn't actually sell that many albums anymore. She's, you know, Taylor was had the number one album of last year and the number one tour and is the number one, you know, celebrity on paparazzi radar. So I think she's just in another league.
The guy who's figured out the best version of a celebrity is Mookie Betts. He lives in lives in LA, so there's a kajillion celebrities here. He's not that big. Like, he's like 5'9", 5'10".
Looks like a regular dude.
He slides in. He just goes to Laker games. He goes to, like, Clipper games. He can just go anywhere, and you kind of don't even really know it's Mookie Betts. He has it the best.
He can bowl a 300.
Right.
He makes $300 million. He makes a $300 million contract, and he just has a kick-ass house in the Valley and lives his life.
You know,
pretty great.
You know who's up there in a stop the restaurant party standpoint? I talked about this on Sunday night as Shaq, just because of the size and how recognizable he is.
Yeah, the NBA guys obviously have
it's a huge advantage. Brady has it too. Brady's like 6'6". So when he comes in, he's like 6 inches, 9 inches taller than everybody. You just notice him.
And you can also probably push him over. A light breeze would push him over these days.
Come on. All right, Matt Bellamy.
I know you're friends. Can you tell him to eat a sandwich, please?
Not friends with Brady.
I'm not. You just idolize him.
Once upon a time. Yeah.
If he played for my team, I would idolize him too.
Matt Bellamy, you can listen to him on The Town. You can read him on The Puck, an excellent website. And then what else? Anything? That's it.
What else? I don't know. That's it. Okay. Yeah. Listen to The Town. Read my Puck newsletter called What I'm Hearing. That's it.
Someday Craig Horlbeck will stop a restaurant.
Someday. He will be.
It's going to happen soon. It might be a TGI Fridays. Thanks, Bellamy.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for the podcast. Thanks to Brian Curtis and Matt Bellany. Thanks to Sarudi and Kyle and Gahau as well. Don't forget, you can watch this on the Bill Simmons YouTube channel. You can also watch this on Spotify. I hope you did, because we're going video podcast from now on Spotify. And new rewatchables we put up on Monday night, the Blues Brothers. If you missed it, I will have another podcast for you on Thursday. Enjoy the middle of the week.